Log Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Family Matters, and I'm Jill Ajizi with my lovely co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, everybody.
How are you?
Oh, great. I'm great. Thank you.
Good. You had a great day today, you told me. You were working in Cook County Family Court, which isn't always a fun job, but today was a good day for you, huh?
Today was a good day. We got some good things accomplished, and we were able to help some families, so you can't ask more than that.
That's right. That's the important part, helping families and children all over the country, and you're doing it in Illinois so wonderfully and boldly and just taking steps that are revolutionary, and I'm so proud of you, and I'm so proud to know you. You have your outstanding book, The Good Karma Divorce, which is doing quite well. And tell me a little bit about the book, Michelle.
Well, it's a book to, you know, because mainly our audience tonight has to do with parent alienation. The Good Karma Divorce, a third of it is devoted to parenting skills to make sure that it never goes to this level. The Good Karma Divorce is how to reduce anger and all of the difficult emotions that make you so reactionary and make people so frightened, where they start clutching at their children as if it's the only asset, and that's what destroys children. So, you know, I'm driven in my interest in what you're doing, Jill, because I think that you are showing the end of the continuum and what could happen, and that's what our guests are going to talk about today. But tell us a little bit about your Dr. Phil experience.
Well, it was interesting, to say the least. It was it's always exciting to go to Beverly Hills, of course, and be in that whole kind of spotlight. And going to the Dr. Phil show, they had tried for many weeks to find a couple that were in the throes of parental alienation. And, of course, that animal really doesn't exist, because an alienator is not going to go on television and say, yes, I've alienated my children. So we searched high and low, and I bet I talked to 150 different people, got hung up on, got called names, and finally, you know, called them and said, there isn't anybody, and they found a couple. Well, the couple that they found was really a really bad parenting situation, not really a true parental alienation situation, even though that can occur in intact marriages. But all of these people had contact with these children, and there was a lot of name calling back and forth between the adults. So it really was a kind of a Jerry Springer type atmosphere, and I hope. And we had a long discussion afterwards, Dr. Phil and I, about the possibility of doing an entire show based solely on parental alienation. And we've talked about three different scenarios for that show. So keep your fingers crossed and keep those emails going to that email address on Dr. Phil's website, because I think it's important that he hears from all of us to understand the importance. And he does understand the importance. There's just some education that needs to happen there. So I think it'll happen, and we'll just pray that it does.
Well, you were terrific, though. I got to hand it to you. I thought you stayed right on message for
You got to talk fast in a minute and 42 seconds. So.
No, but
you got to get in what you can. So anyway, let's get to our guest, Michelle, because we have some great people on tonight, and Dr. Glenn Caddy is on with us. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you very much. Very much.
You're down in my second stomping ground, and actually Michelle is from Miami, so you're in our stomping ground, and I hope the weather is lovely there today. I miss it, and I can't wait to get there. But you're down there doing all kinds of great work. Tell us a little bit about what you do there in Fort Lauderdale and up really all over the place.
Well, I'm in Fort Lauderdale, that's right. And actually, it's raining right at the moment, but it normally is wonderful. The work that I do, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist, and while I deal with a lot of cases that have nothing to do with family matters, I also have a lot of cases that deal directly with family matters. And unfortunately, when I get hired on one side or another of these cases, I always seem to get hired on very contentious and very, very difficult divorces. And as a general rule, those divorces tend to be funded relatively well. Sadly, many people who are going through divorce who can have, you know, really terrible circumstances and conflicts and alienations with children and all the rest of it, they often can't actually successfully bring their matters to the court because for funding and other considerations. But the lawyers who hire me typically are involved in very high conflict divorces.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when I get asked to try and, you know, serve the best interests of, ultimately my job is to serve the best interests of the children and determine what's really going on, and work out how to try and design a set of recommendations to the court, and sometimes also to the lawyers, because if we can resolve these matters without the court ultimately having to make the final decisions, that's often good. But in many of the cases that I get involved in, the level of conflict is so great that, you know, one side will, be adversarial to the other right up until the bitter end, and often long after that, for that matter. But,
Michelle, how important, Michelle, is Glenn in cases that you work with? How important is his role?
I have a question, and then I'll answer that. Glenn, are you doing cases that have to do with child custody, or are you an expert on alienation?
No, I do a lot of child custody cases, and I am an expert in alienation, only because, unfortunately, I've had to work with too many cases of alienation over the years.
You ever get hired just after there's some kind of finding that there's an alienation, and they bring you on as an expert to try and address just that?
Yes. It's sometimes the case that I get hired. There's been a custody evaluation done. In fact, I'm involved in one at the moment, this one up in Canada, in which a determination as far as the mental health expert is concerned about what the correct custody evaluation, what the correct custody should involve. And in this particular case, the recommendation doesn't go anywhere near far enough. It basically advises the court, in their opinion, that the children ought to go with one parent as opposed to the other, in this case to the father rather than principally to the mother. And it makes an inference that the mother is unfit, and it links to various elements of possible alienation. Unfortunately, the recommendations simply stop at the notion of the recommendation about who should be the primary parent, and it doesn't address anything to do with any aspects of remediation or any solutions to the long-term issues for the parents and for the child or children.
And your job
there are four children.
Doesn't preclude that? Because
in
Chicago, we're allowed to ask an expert to not only make recommendations, but long-term recommendations, and do this, and don't do this, and do that. They give us a whole recipe.
Well, and that's what would make good sense, but, you know, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of experts out there who prepare reports that stop short of the composite set of recommendations that really are necessary, to guide, to offer the court guidance and to potentially guide the two sides in what they ought to do, you know, where we go from there, because, you know, reaching an opinion about, which side of a case should have the primary responsibility for the day-to-day parenting, when there's been high conflict divorce and when there's a lot of chaos in the family, even in the absence of full-blown parental alienation, is, sort of gets you to only phase one And it doesn't, you know, so from that point on, and this provider of the person who in this case was actually rendering the recommendations, hadn't bothered to go to the next step and wasn't even sure that she understood what the next step should be. So perhaps this particular person should have never been hired in the first place.
In answer to Jill's question, the experts have a great deal of weight within the court. And that's not to say they have the last word. Not at all. And I have, on numerous occasions, not followed the expert necessarily. But a good expert with good testimony, it really is very impactful. Because,
oh, absolutely.
So a judge can go along with an expert if they want to and not have to worry that they're making a mistake because they just went along with an expert who's an expert. So you see what I mean, Jill?
Yes, absolutely. You make it very clear. I think what Glenn does is crucial to so many parental alienation cases, and I think there's so many parents out there who don't know what the next step is in court, and trying to find someone like Glenn is so incredibly difficult because there aren't that many people in the United States and Canada that are experts in parental alienation. So finding someone like him is like finding a nugget of gold to bring in and shine light on a situation that could make a difference in a child's life.
Well, I think the other issues too are that while parental alienation is incredibly toxic, the truth of the matter is that the other issues that are critical to determine around the interests of children, you know, right at the same level as parental alienation, is whether in fact what we've got is parental alienation or whether we've got a realistic estrangement between the child and one of the parents.
How do you know? How can you tell?
In the case of parental alienation, what you have is a child or children who reject a parent, typically in the absence of reason, and usually as a result of the favored parent's use of parental alienation strategies. And so you've got both the element of the child's rejection on an invalid basis, on a not rational basis, and you've got evidence that has to come forth about the extent to which the parent who that child is giving inordinate favor to, having acted in ways that dramatically facilitate the development of that alienation. Now,
you hit the heart of the issue, which is really the alienating parent often says, "I didn't do this; it was what she did." So how do you distinguish when it's estrangement? Give me an example of what constitutes estrangement. Is that a battering parent? That's a good reason.
Well,
I mean, how do you know?
Yeah, in the case of what I call realistic estrangement, what we have is a child rejecting a parent for a reason, and the issue becomes, is that reason in itself justifiable, or are there a series of reasons? And a good example of reason would be, as you said, abuse on the part of the rejected parent, mm-hmm. and withdrawal on the part of the rejected parent. So not only, or, you know, where you have abuse and then withdrawal and disconnect, and so that you may have estrangement, but you have estrangement that has a rational basis. The child is either afraid of, legitimately afraid, not illegitimately, and or the other parent simply withdraws from the entire situation, leaving a void, and with the other parent having all of the responsibility to shoulder, and the child sees this and aligns themselves with the parent, who hasn't been abusive or hasn't been rejecting. It's terribly important to discriminate which of these two things we're dealing with, because in both instances, the child is likely to be negative towards one, and or the children, and favorable towards the other. And by the way, let me make a point here. It's not just necessarily the child and children. There can be grandparents, you know, there may be alienation induced by grandparents. There may be alienation induced by an older brother or sister. There's, you know, there are lots of different moving parts in here, though often we tend to just keep it simple and talk about the alienating parent or the realistically estranging parent, et cetera, et cetera.
I can
That's important to point out, isn't it, Glenn, that the tentacles of parental alienation do reach into every part of the family, and that it can be more than just a target parent. Grandparents are very often involved in that alienating process, and it is just so incredibly sad to me to involve an entire family and cut out half of a child's heritage and loving family. And I watch my parents every day with the sadness of not seeing their grandchildren, and it's just so incredibly heartbreaking. I just want to say we all know, I don't think we need to give the definition of what parental alienation is. We all know what it is, and certainly when I look at the other guests that we have on the show tonight, her story, Pamela Richardson, it is very close to what mine is, save one thing. And in her case, Pamela Richardson's case, it meant losing her child. So it's the ultimate in parental alienation. And Pamela, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for being so patient with us while we chatted with Glenn, and we'll try to get into a four-way conversation in just a second. But I wanted you to tell us about yourself. You're up in Vancouver, one of my favorite places, one of the most beautiful, clean cities in the world, and tell us what you're doing up there now.
Well, you know, my main thrust in writing A Kidnapped Mind was twofold. First of all, it was my last gift to that lovely brown hair, brown-eyed boy, my son Dashiell, who lived a horrible life and died in a tragically, unnecessarily horrible way. And the other reason I wrote it was because I believe very, very strongly that education about what this form of child abuse is capable of doing. And so my husband David and I have formed a foundation called the Dash Foundation, and what we do is we gift A Kidnapped Mind to as many organizations, as many lecturers and schools, libraries, judiciary, you name it, as a way of promoting an awareness of how dangerous parental alienation can be.
And your book, unlike mine was written in novel form. Yours is written, it is not fiction, and it is just absolutely heart-wrenching what you went through. And every alienated parent understands that heartbreak and pain, but you really had it heaped on you. How did you deal with that loss of your son?
Well, you know, I fought for Dash for a long time. I was in court for over 12 years, and I was married to a criminal lawyer, and he used the system and used his son as a weapon, and he was very, very effective. And you'll have to remember that I published this book 4 years ago. So when I first was in the court system, it was in, you know, it was 10 years ago or more. And I didn't even know what actually was going on in the very beginning. And there was no definition for parental alienation. And it took me a number of years to source out Dr. Richard Gardner and his book and his work. So my journey was at the very, very beginning. And, you know, I must say that we have come a long way. We need to go much further. But when I was in the court system, it was I mean, you couldn't even mention parental alienation because it was really regarded as psychobabble.
Right.
And not a real, and you ended up spending far too much time trying to defend a syndrome as opposed to dealing with the issues of what your child or children were going through.
May I ask you a question? I'm not exactly clear of the sequence of events. Had you written a book while Dash was still alive?
No, I wrote it. I started writing it as soon as he died. I think I was so full of rage that I wanted to turn it into something productive and to try and help other people. And I also ran a half marathon because, you know, one of the things as an alienated parent that you live with every day is a tremendous feeling of helplessness. Over and above the public embarrassment of a woman who doesn't have a relationship with her children, and society is being more educated now. But, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, if you weren't seeing your child or you didn't have custody of your child or your child didn't want to see you and you were the mother, there was a tremendous amount of social difficulty.
Stigma, right.
Absolutely. So, you know, I had to not let that destroy me. And so I wrote the book after my son died. And I ran a half marathon to deal with the anger, which really helped.
Did the book help you?
Pardon me?
Did the book help you a lot?
I think it must have. You know, the other thing about losing a child like I did is by the time that Dash did pass away, I had lost him a long time ago. And the child that he was, there was very little left.
Yeah.
You know, he was 4.5 years old when he went to live with his father. And so by the time at 16 that he died, I had struggled with his relationship for a long, long time. It's very different than having dinner with your family and your child goes out for the evening and jumps off a bridge.
Right.
So I had this very, very long, tenuous relationship, never giving up, ever.
Had it ever changed? Was there ever signs of hope, or did it just
freeze? A lot of signs there were, but, you know, the courts in that era, in that time, you know, there were no teeth in the court orders. I went back so many times with legitimate reasons. To demand that my access be to be instated and upheld, and then demand for, and I finally got, and I could have got whole custody, but there was no point in doing that at that stage because I would have been doing exactly what the father to the child would think had been done to me, and so I went for joint custody, but the damage had been done. You know, what happens with parental alienation, as I think we all are very clear now, is that the indoctrination takes place and eventually the child takes on the denigration all by itself, himself or their self. You know, the parent doesn't need to keep indoctrinating a child after a certain period of time. And that's where the difficulties manifest themselves in a court system when a 12-year-old child says to the judge, I don't want to see my fill-in-the-blank, mother or father. And the alienator says, I haven't said anything. And you know what? They probably by then haven't.
Yes, it's already internalized.
Dr. Goldstein said to me, the other day I was talking to Dr. Saul Goldstein from Toronto, and I said, how long, and Glenn, you can comment on this, I said, how long do parents who have some contact with their children, maybe at the moderate level of parental alienation, have to walk on eggshells around their children, you know, if you can get them to come over, if you can get them to talk to you, if you can get them not to kick you or spit at you or call you names, how long do you have to put up with that? And he said, you know, he said, there's there's an unwritten Jewish law that when a woman is having a baby and you're in the delivery room with her and you're the husband, that everything that is said or done in that delivery room is forgiven and forgotten. And that these children, it's the same thing, that these children are not the children that we knew, and the character and the behaviors that we helped develop and that we put instilled in them is gone. Those children are gone and they will never come back. And it just, it broke my heart to think that I worked so hard to try to develop wonderful characters and that part of me is gone from those children. And so, Glenn, how do you think an alienated parent should deal with children who they still have access to, albeit that, you know, that rude, disrespectful access?
Good question.
I think it's a great question. I think that what the parent who has been alienated needs to really try and come to grips with, and it's very, very difficult, is that your child actually has a mental disturbance. Your child has a distorted belief system in which they have been so manipulated that they cannot use good logic and good rational problem solving to identify what the truth is. And so, just as in the case of cult figures who manipulate people to believing the inconceivable, so too the alienated child suffers a shared delusional disorder with the perpetrator of the delusion. Now, you know, if in many respects that delusion may be incredibly painful to the parent who's been victimized by the alienation, but you really have got to come to understand that this child is not doing this of their own free will. They're doing it from a deluded, literally a deluded belief system. And to understand that gives you the first step with professional help of being able to work through your own pain in understanding that they're not rejecting you because they don't know you. They're rejecting a construct that's been built within them that is invalid. And that construct was created by somebody who wished to destroy your relationship with that young person.
So the idea that a parent would turn around and say to a child, you can't disrespect me like that, I'm your father, I'm your mother, that's the wrong sentence. Because what is the practical advice? Because these moderate or midway alienation cases where there still is some attachment, those are almost more prevalent. And I see them more at the time. So how does a parent know how to act?
Well,
is it passive?
You know what the problem is? In the vast number of cases, the parent does not know how to react because it's just outside of the scope of the parent's experience. They've never had, you know, we don't train parents to deal with significant psychopathology in a child who otherwise probably may well be excelling in a number of respects. You know, I've heard parents say, look, you know, he's getting all A's in school. How can there be, you know, how can there be anything wrong with it?
All the time.
Et cetera. You know, he's loved by his friends. How dare you say that there's something disturbed about him or her? But the fact of the matter is that, so these parents simply aren't equipped. And really what they need to do is not go and see a mental health professional, because a lot of mental health professionals aren't very well equipped to handle this either. They really need to find a professional with whom they can work who really gets the dynamic of that alienation as being delusional and who is prepared to work with them to help them in a progressive deprogramming sense. You certainly cannot criticize the child and say, how dare you speak to me like that?
Pamela, I want to ask Pamela, Glenn, before you go on.
Yep, go
when
on.
You were, when you figured out, Pamela, what, when you finally got to Richard Gardner and you discovered the words and you knew what it was, were there people that you could find, like Glenn is suggesting, to help you?
Yes.
With, and how did you locate them?
Well, you know, I think, you know, you use every source and every method that you can. There was a very, very well-known child psychologist that was actually in my area. And his method was that he actually dealt with the parents, which suited, you know, my needs in particular, because he was the one that said, you have to find Dr. Gardner. He has written a book about what I think your son is going through. And he also helped me with what I kept seeing as a deteriorating behavior between my son and myself, and what once was an easygoing, happy, relaxed, lovely, average little boy. And I have a question that I kept saying, how can a child who when his parents were together, had an equally loving and caring and reciprocal relationship with both those parents, and he lives now predominantly with one parent and has chosen to dislike and then hate and reject the other parent? How does that happen? I mean, to me, it's very clear. He's living in one house predominantly. His history is that he had a lovely, sharing, reciprocally warm relationship with both. And now you see a deterioration, and it wasn't just with me. It was with the entire family, his grandparents, his stepbrothers, his aunts and uncles. And he eventually, of course, it gets into the school system, and he starts spiraling at school. So that's
I go back to Dr. Caddy, because I know you don't say you can't do that to me, that's disrespectful. When you're being really abused by a child, what kind of demeanor do you adopt for those people who don't have access to a good therapist who specializes in this? What do you do?
One of the things that I routinely say to parents with whom I work on this sort of thing is, firstly, whatever you do, you maintain your own cool. You have got to be the master of your emotions, because children who operate this way will use any vehicle at all, any piece of evidence that they can find to help validate their point of view. And so your natural tendency to be frustrated or irritated or whatever it might be under those circumstances, or hurt and try and cope, the children will often attach to that, and there will be one more nail in your coffin. The task has to be kind to them, even when they're being nasty to you. On the other hand, what you certainly can say is, let me ask you this, son, or let me ask you this, darling. Do you consider that what you're saying right at the moment is courteous? So you take it away from how you're being treated, how you're being offended, mm-hmm. and place the notion back on the child. Is this courteous? Do you believe that you have a need, a desire, or an obligation to be courteous, or to be kind, or to be discourteous in your dealings with other human beings? Not me, other human beings. And mostly the child will understand that they do have such an obligation, but they will also believe that that obligation defaults when it comes to you.
Right.
But if you can get them, because you don't deserve to be, because you have been so bad that you are excluded from the right of being treated with courtesy. And so what we have to do with this child is to slowly help him or her, or them, because often it's a small crowd. I've got a case involving four children at the moment. And so what I'm proposing is that you work to them or towards trying to get them to understand that they have a duty to all people and, most importantly, to themselves, to manage themselves in a manner that is kind and courteous to other human beings. So you draw on the obligation of humanism.
Do you want to draw the child out to try and get them to, if they get to get the venom out, is that favorable? Or is it all just programmed and not even the real heart of it?
No, I think the issue is if they explode with you and are really venomous, the next question is, could you tell me why it is the case that in your dealings with me, you are being so cruel? As opposed to, you know, you little son of a bitch or something, you know, and there's no value in criticizing the child. The child is the victim. He or she doesn't deserve yet one more assault. And, of course, all that will do is further harm, it further validate them in their perspective, their distorted perspective about you. So kindness and being in control of your own emotions has to be the guiding force. And now, if it's the case that you are doing that, and especially if you're getting some good professional help, so that you can role play with the clinician how to do this, or if you have a close friend who's just very sophisticated interpersonally and has got a good handle on you know, life and on dealing with children, somebody who's unusually skilled, draw on their resource in order to try and help you develop the ability to turn the lights on as best you can inside this child's head, so that perhaps what you can do is create some sense of, let me think about what was said to me, as opposed to simply rejecting outright anything that the alienated parent puts on.
Underneath the kidnapped mind, what is in that? What does that child feel? What did Pamela's son feel in reality, or what does any other alienated child feel toward that target parent deep down inside?
Deep down inside is a great deal of emotional intensity, because if there wasn't a great deal of emotional intensity, they wouldn't be able to generate the mistreatment of the parent and the abuse that they engage in. What is fascinating is when you work with these children for a while, you slowly see them transforming. You recognize that they can be influenced by logical dialogue, but in order for that to happen, they have to actually paradoxically, for a time, be separated from the perpetrator. Because so long as they are in the immediate care and attention of the alienating parent, they will buy into the distortion.
Pamela, in Pamela, in your case, was there ever any talk within the court system about removing Dash from his custody and giving him to you full-time to get him out of that alienating situation?
Well, only because it was suggested so many times by me. And we did have a breakthrough where he was allowed uninterrupted, unfettered time with me. And it was an amazing 2 weeks that we had. We went up to Whistler to our cabin up there and spent some amazing quality time together. But there was always somebody at the gate. You know, there was a friend of a friend trying to call him. And, you know, the interference was extreme. And when we drove back to Vancouver, it was almost like a change that came over him as soon as we approached the city. And he tried to jump out of the car several times. And it was frightening, and I was holding on to him because the car was moving. It was that powerful that he knew he was back, and that he had to, you know, his job was to get away. Mm-hmm. And we were almost at the house, and we stopped at a stop sign, and he opened the door again and left.
Was he in therapy?
The father said that he doesn't want to go to therapy, and he said to the judge, and you know and I know that if a child or anybody isn't willing to go, that it's a waste of time. So the judge agreed with him and never wanted to.
What's the argument?
Dr. Sweeney, what about that child who says, I don't want to go to therapy? How do I have that in my courtroom. That's not rare. What do you do?
I think that especially if you have good expert opinion recommending to the contrary, you require the parent to make sure that the child is in therapy, and you hope that the therapist that is seeing this child is sophisticated enough to outmaneuver the child and slowly work to disempower the child to have the level of negative attitude towards the other parent that exists, and then you work with as many family systems as you can introduce to help the child slowly reformat. But let me assure you that when a child suffers this type of delusional disorder, it can be devastating in its consequences.
Glenn,
I say,
is it something that lasts into adulthood and can cross generations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because think about it. You know, we have a child who, let's assume that the alienation persists into adulthood. It may well be, what's happened is that child has lost a childhood. It has lost, the child has lost all of the learning experiences that would otherwise be available to it from the other parent. So from the point of view of the software development of that child's thinking, if we can think about the laying down of knowledge and information and perspective and beliefs and attitudes as part of the software development, that child is changed by this process. And you can never get that back. And perhaps, as an adult, the child can eventually recapture a quality relationship with the alienated parent. But the child will be changed by that process forever.
How often do you see a child come back to that target parent?
In adulthood? You mean?
Yeah.
Or in the course? Well, you know, it's often very difficult
adulthood.
To answer that question. In adulthood, it's often very difficult for me to answer that question because there are many times when I am involved with this family for a period of time around the crisis of the dissolution of the marriage and the decisions that occur after. And as an expert, I don't continue on over years and years with these children.
Cases,
but
right.
Let me tell you that at the present time, I have a 52-year-old woman in therapy with me who is professionally very successful and is the child victim of alienation. And her entire life and her emotional life has been based on trying to resolve her sense of upset with both of her parents mm-hmm. for what they, one way or another, put her through. Her mother for not being able to prevent the alienation, and her father from being cruel enough to induce it.
And what about her guilt? Is that a big piece of it?
Her guilt is significant. Her guilt is significant. The other thing that has happened with her is she's had trouble in the rearing of her own children because she has been so exceptionally overprotective that it in itself has been pathological. She has tried to compensate in the rearing of her own children so substantially. And interestingly, it was that that brought her into therapy.
That her children were rebelling?
Her own adolescent, now adult daughter, was sort of rebelling because mother was still trying to micromanage aspects of her life as an adult and still trying to protect her. And in this particular instance, the protection was to be protecting her or trying to protect her against a new relationship that she'd started.
Are her parents alive?
Beg pardon?
Are the alienating parents still alive in this case?
The alienating parent is now dead.
And what about the targeted parent? Did she ever form a relationship with the targeted parent?
The targeted parent, she did form a relationship with, but she'd lost so much time. She didn't see the targeted parent for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
And so, how do you, hi, Mom. Well, what have you been doing over the last 20 years?
Glenn, don't you think there's a break of attachment that happens in this process that can never be really repaired?
We really have to see it as what it is, and it's just as serious as cult behavior is. It produces the same sort of distortions of fact and logic and ability to link back into, when a cult figure succeeds in taking children away, young adults away, and converting them, their relationship with their parents are terribly changed.
And Glenn, I mean, I think it's so important because I talk to alienated parents all day, every day, all day long, and so many of them are hopeful of the day when that knock comes at the door and that child walks through the door and they're going to renew that relationship. That is not going to happen. The relationship is not there anymore. From that day forward, you may have a relationship, but it will not be anywhere close to what you knew before. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And part of the problem is also often with the alienated parent, because the alienated parent, before the relationship deteriorates completely, has often tried so many thousands of times, so many over and over again. Eventually, especially I've got a case at the moment where the child who's been involved as the victim of alienation has been so profoundly abusive to the mother for so long, and the mother has tried so hard, the mother has had to learn to protect herself. Now the alienated child is an adult of 25, profoundly drug involved, several abortions later, unable to maintain gainful employment. The mother wants to reach out and help her, but the mother has had to learn to protect herself because the next assault will come because this child has become so pathological and believes that the mother, is now trying to help her to make up for all of the ills that occurred in her childhood, and she rejects it. And so it's a hideous situation where even many years later, reconciliation has been exceptionally difficult. In this case, perhaps impossible.
I would like to ask Pamela and Glenn, what would you, and respectively and separately, what would you like to see the system do differently? What would you like to see the judges do differently or the lawyers?
And I just want to interject one thing before Pamela speaks, is that it's the same everywhere. I mean, the Canadian system is different, the court system, but everything that happens is the same in this, with this parental alienation thing. Don't you think, Pamela, in Canada?
Right, Joe. It's and I'm involved in organizations around the world, and it's not even just in North America. It's global. Here it is in a little bit of a nutshell. First of all, the legal system is a criminal system, certainly in North America and in parts of Europe. And it really wasn't made for family law. And so that in itself makes it an adversarial area. And family law has become a huge part of the legal system since, the 1950s or 60s or 70s. And so you're first of all, you're in an adversarial environment, which is not conducive to any kind of conciliatory outcome, especially if you've got a parent capable of alienation. Having said that, the courts have got to start being super parents. And they have to start making decisions with the best interest of the child. And over again, I see it happening too little, too late. There seems to be a stigma about changing custody. And yet, if one of those parents died, custody would be changed instantly. And I think that these cases get so tangled up in the court system in many cases because the courts don't act as super parents and use their authority in the first place. The access orders don't have enough teeth in them. There are no consequences to the actions of alienating parents. I mean, that's got to change.
Right.
Yeah.
It's going to change
a
little bit, way too slowly. And Doctor, what do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. And the first thing is, it's interesting to me that that in criminal court, the judiciary, once a person has been found guilty, don't seem to have any particular problem at all mandating very meaningful sentences. But in family court, it seems like way too many judges spend a lot of time doing everything they can to avoid a decision. Let the process sort itself out. And there are times when perhaps that happens in everyday common sense relationships, but in these alienating cases, the courts have to be willing to take a very firm stance. And they also have to be willing, it seems to me, to weigh very carefully their willingness to take all that much notice. I've been concerned about the extent to which a number of judges in my jurisdictions have listened, given so much weight to children in cases where there is meaningful alienation. And that is like giving the enemy all of the ammunition that they would ever want. One has to be very, very sensitive to what the basis of the child's wishes are and what are the factual foundations by which that child would reach some of these conclusions. And in a number of cases, of course, there aren't experts involved in these processes, and the courts are left with an incredibly difficult task about how to do their own analysis. That's not really what the court system is well served to do. The other consideration, of course, is that there are so many people coming through the legal system all of the time that it's got to be extremely difficult. Judges, it takes a very special person to be, a judge in family court, simply because, as is often said in the legal system, the criminal court sees bad people at their best and the and the family court sees good people at their worst, but sometimes they fail to see bad people or be able to discriminate good from bad, and that is a very difficult task. I think the other concern is that courts inevitably find for or against somebody, and then that's the end of the day. And if that's the order, that order stands unless a substantial change of circumstance can be brought. But in the state, in the condition of parental alienation, it's often extremely unlikely that there will be a substantial change of circumstance brought, because the system of the alienation perpetuates itself so very well. And that makes the task of the court that much more difficult.
Well, I like to see everybody listening in the beginning stages of the cases. If you believe that there's an alienation and you could get the judge to find out early on, and if the judge suspects there, you might be right and there's a pattern of alienation starting, or even well into the alienation, get it written in a court order. So because 3 years down the line, the judge will look at you and say, "You two back again," as if you're both crazy sometimes, and you'll want that in a court order to show the blueprint to a new judge. There was a finding of some alienation. It is in the record. Because when you're
and hopefully, Michelle, there are judges listening and judges that can take what you do every day and hone their skills in family court. Because
well, I'm thinking that the,
it's easy to say. It's easy to say, and there's people out there who've tried to get judges to listen, who've tried to get judges to understand, and it's so difficult to have them make that step. And make the right decision for what is in the best interest of a child. You're doing it, and if people could do what you're doing, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now.
Well, the only reason I'm saying it, Jill, is so that the litigants who are involved say to their lawyer, not all lawyers are sophisticated about alienation.
Really? Are you kidding me?
You've got to educate your own lawyers, and you've got to ask your lawyers, please see if you can't get it in a court order with the judge. To help them out. Excuse me. You got to help out your lawyer sometimes.
Definitely.
You'd be surprised if people don't know about it.
I'm involved in a case at the moment where it's been going on for 11 years, and five different judges have recused themselves in this one case.
Well, and that happens all
that
the time.
Case.
I mean, I had three. So it happens all the time, and if you're recusing and passing it off to the next person, it doesn't help, because time is the friend of an alienator, and if a judge cannot make a swift decision and make that move for that child, it gives that alienator so much more time to work on the mind, or the heart, mind, and soul of that child and destroy him or her.
I would like
that
to see in court orders, just really briefly, I'd like to see in court orders that if, like, three visitations are missed or something like that, that the orders are self-actualizing, that you don't have to go to court to get the child immediately into counseling, that if such and such happens, contingent on that, you go right to counseling, and you don't wait for 15 continuances in the court, because what Jill said is right. Time is on the side of the alienator, and I would like to see that people push for that in their orders.
Well, and also the alienator will take advantage of that, and you know how easily you can delay any kind of court hearing at all.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I cannot believe this has flown by, and I want to have you both back, and Michelle and I would love to host another show with both of you, because it's been so incredibly interesting. Pamela, I want to just get your contact information for the Dash Foundation and any other information that you'd like to give to people, because out there are people like you were so many years ago looking for that answer, and you may have it for them. So can you give your information?
I certainly will. Everyone is welcome to go to my website, and everything is there.
Okay.
So my website is www.akidnapmind.com.
Great.
And you can also, there's email address that you can reach me directly from the website as well.
Okay, wonderful. And Glenn, you are all over the country, all over North America, working. How can people get a hold of you if they need someone like you on their case?
Well, they can Google me. Firstly, it's Dr. Glenn Ross Caddy, C-A-D-D-Y, Glenn with two N's. Or they can contact me at my office, head office in Fort Lauderdale, which is 954-565-8850. Or they can email me at Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, dot Caddy, C-A-D-D-Y, at gmail.com.
Wonderful. You guys are great. Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks so
much. Again.
Terrific show, guys. Really.
Very terrific.
I learned so much.
I'll talk to you all soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. All of you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Bye.